that they've loved, all that they've fought for, all that they've stood for, will now be put to the test. Star Trek III, The Search for Spock.
The word, sir?
The word is no. I am therefore going anyway.
You do this, you'll never sit in the captain's chair again.
Engage auto systems. Clear all moorings.
Cleared, sir.
1/4 impulse power.
Someone is stealing the Enterprise.
Warp speed.
Klingon bird of bracer. She's arming torpedoes.
Shields up.
The shield's non-responsive.
Fuck!
We're a sitting duck.
Join us on this, the final voyage of the Starship Enterprise. Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. The adventure continues.
And it seems like just yesterday we had my friend and film historian Ray Morton on here to talk about Jaws 2. And wow, almost 2 months have gone by and he's back again, ladies and gentlemen.
Can't keep me away.
Well, I'm glad because I always seem to learn something or either you cause me to bring back a memory that something I've forgotten that's pressed between the pages of my mind, shall we say, when we have these discussions. So tonight we're going to be talking, or I say tonight, we're taping at night, but you may be listening to it in the daytime, dear listeners. But anyway, we're going to be discussing Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, on the occasion of its 40th anniversary. We did Star Trek The Motion Picture and Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, when I was co-hosting Movie Geeks United, so we're just going to continue on that trajectory, and I can't believe that it's 40 years since the release of Star Trek The Motion Picture. This is just, it still blows my mind. Star Trek III, rather, not Star Trek The Motion Picture, Star Trek III, 40 years this coming summer. Yeah. But
I remember standing in line the night I saw it, and it didn't feel like 40 years ago, but what can you do?
Yeah. Yes, it grossed over $16 million from almost 2,000 theaters across North America and went on to gross, that was in its first week of release, and it went on to gross $76 million at the box office with a total of $87 million worldwide. But we're going to talk about, you know, how this came to be, and I guess we could just pick it up where we left off. As The Wrath of Khan was released in June of 1982 to rapturous praise, I would say.
Yes, great praise and great box office.
Yes.
And, you know, studios being what they are. I mean, Star Trek II was a gamble because Star Trek The Motion Picture had come out. And as we had discussed, was a very big hit financially, but it had cost so much money that it wasn't really profitable. So Paramount's thought was, how can we do Star Trek, but do it at a good price and make it profitable? So they had Star Trek II had been produced through the television division of Paramount. Essentially, it was begun as a TV movie, and when it sort of shaped up to be better than that, the studio put a little bit more money into it. But I believe its final cost was somewhere around $11 million. Probably a little more with the advertising and such. And that was about 1/4 of what Star Trek The Motion Picture cost. And it was all done, a lot of it was done using reused sets and some reused special effects. So they did it in kind of a, not a cheap way, but they did it very economically. And it just turned out to be a terrific movie thanks to the writing and directing of Nick Meyer. And, you know, a number of other factors, some great effects by ILM and so on. So, of course, it was a hit and Paramount was thrilled. And then there was the thought that, well, maybe this will now be an ongoing film series, because one of the original ideas was that Star Trek II was supposed to be essentially the pilot for a possible new Star Trek series. And in the early stages, the idea was that Kirk's son, David, and Kirstie Alley's character, Savick, were going to sort of be the leads of that show. And then the other actors might, you know, sort of drop in and guest performances and things. But that was one of the original ideas behind making Star Trek II. Once it was the sizable hit that it was, Paramount abandoned that idea and said, you know, let's focus on making it an ongoing film series. So they immediately brought Harve Bennett back on board. Harve Bennett had been the executive producer of Star Trek II, and he was the originator of the story. And it was felt that he was, you know, he had been mostly a television producer throughout his life and knew how to, bring a picture in on budget. So he was brought back. The executive producer this time was a man named Gary Nardino. And Gary Nardino at that time was the president of Paramount Television. So he had actually was the unofficial executive producer, or I should say uncredited executive producer of Star Trek II. This time he took a credit. And this is just an aside, but I worked for Gary a number of years later. I was a writer on a TV show that he produced, and he was a literally larger than life character, both personality wise and physically wise, and bit of a gruff guy, but he knew how to do a thing on budget. And he was always very sharp about, you know, here's the job at hand, we're going to get it done. And that's why Paramount kind of entrusted the Star Trek series to him. So he brought Harve Bennett back. And they approached Nicholas Meyer, and Nicholas Meyer did not want to do the film as director. He was famously unhappy with the sort of open end of Star Trek II. His feeling was they killed off Spock and he should stay dead. And so he did not participate in the reshoot at the end where they showed you his casket on the planet, which, you know, suggests that he might come back. Meyer didn't like that. He thought they should stick with the original idea. So when Paramount came back to him and said, you want to do Star Trek III, everybody knew it was going to be about bringing Spock back. Nobody was under any illusions that they were going to not have Leonard Nimoy come back. So Nicholas Meyer said no. And so Harve Bennett got to work, and he wrote an outline, which was called Return to Genesis, being the planet that was created at the end of Star Trek II. And the original outline was pretty interesting. Roughly the idea that the main Star Trek crew stole the Enterprise to go back to Genesis to get Spock, that was in place. The Spock stuff was very, very different than the original outline. The idea was in some ways that perhaps he had not died. Because it sort of had a double plot to it. The first was that the Enterprise crew comes back home to Earth and they start seeing apparitions of Spock, like in mirrors and things like that. And he sort of suggests that I'm still alive and you have to go back to Genesis to get me. And that prompts them to steal the Enterprise and go back. And then meanwhile, the main villains of the original outline were Romulans. And the idea was they landed on the Genesis planet because they could mine dilithium, you know, the magic substance that powers all the starships. So they set up a little mining colony, and then one by one, they start getting picked off by some mysterious creature that's living out in the woods of the Genesis planet. And what you come to find out in the end is that it's Spock, and he's reverted to some kind of bestial, you know, mental state, though he's still alive. So the idea was that he hadn't actually died. He was in some kind of stasis or something. And then when he landed on the planet, his consciousness went into all these apparitions, and his body was this sort of feral creature running around killing Romulans. And then the Enterprise crew shows up and they rescue him and they bring him back to Vulcan and somehow put him back together, basically. Kind of an interesting, offbeat, weird idea. Obviously, not much of that made it into the final film, but yeah. But that was Bennett's original idea. And while he was working on that, they obviously needed to find a director. And also they were lining up the cast. As far as I understand it, the cast had only been signed for Star Trek II in a one-off. Like these days, they sign you, you know, for 28 sequels if you do something. But they had only been, I believe, signed for one film. So they when they were bringing everyone in and negotiating and all of that, and obviously they wanted to bring back Leonard Nimoy as Spock, even though he had died in the previous film. And Nimoy had mixed feelings. He figured they were going to want him back, but he also didn't always want to be tied to Star Trek. So he had famously said he always wanted them to offer him something else besides just acting. So when they did Star Trek II, he was given a part in the miniseries A Woman Called Golda, which Harve Bennett had also produced. So Nimoy got Star Trek II and that project. So he was hoping they'd give him another project in addition to being in Star Trek III. And there are several stories about how the idea came up, but at some point he thought, you know what I actually want to do is I want to direct the movie. And he had done a little bit of TV directing and a little bit of stage directing, but for an actor, you know, an actor on his level to ask to direct a big budget science fiction feature film as his first feature, that was a pretty outrageous request. And there was a lot of back and forth about whether the Paramount was going to let him do it or not. But eventually he talked to Nicholas Meyer and he said, you know, how do I negotiate this thing? And Meyer said to him, are you prepared to let the movie get made without you? And he said, yes. He said, then just tell him that and hold tight and you will direct. And he basically told them that. And a few days later, he was given the job to direct because Paramount knew there was no way they were going to get Star Trek III unless they let him direct. And then it all kind of took off from there.
Yeah, there was a quote I found when I was doing my research. It said that Gene Roddenberry's first reaction to the news was that Harve Bennett had hired a director you can't fire, quote unquote.
Yep. Gene was always a big fan of Leonard's. Not at all.
Oh, yeah. Wasn't he, though?
Yes. Yeah, no. They didn't get along very well, those two. But
it's a running gag, folks.
yeah, exactly.
Between those two.
Oh, yeah. Boy. So. Well, that was part of the rest of it. You know, so they did increase the budget a little bit to about $14 million. You know, it was still being produced by the TV division and, you know, $14 million, even in 1983, which is when it all got going, was not a lot, especially for a special effects film. So on the one hand, you know, Nimoy was a big risk. On the other hand, the budget was tightly controlled and they knew that between Nardino and Harve Bennett that, you know, the budget wasn't going to get out of control. And I don't know if they had any like backup for Leonard, but I'm sure there would be some contingency if they ran into trouble. But they didn't, you know. And he and Nimoy and Bennett worked on the script together. So they took the original story Bennett had put together and they turned it into roughly what you ended up seeing. And I think it was Nimoy who said, let's change the Romulans to Klingons because they were the more recognizable and famous villains from the show. And they hadn't really done much in the movies. They were in the opening of Star Trek, the motion picture, but otherwise they had not been a presence. So it was an opportunity to do them, but it also led to one of the more interesting anomalies in the film. You know, the great spaceship that they fly around in is a bird of prey. And if you were a fan of the Star Trek TV series, you knew that that was the ship the Romulans flew around in. So apparently they had already started work on the models and the designs. So they had concocted a backstory that the Klingons had hijacked a Romulan ship. And that's why they were flying around in it. But all that got cut out. So basically, if you're a regular viewer, you don't care. It's just a cool spaceship. If you're a Star Trek fan, you have no idea why Klingons are flying a Romulan ship. But such is many years of nerd back and forth was born with that decision. So,
yes. Yes, indeed. Yeah, this is. It was interesting how they came up with the idea of Spock's restoration, I guess you would say, and
yes.
How they explained that, and that they directly called back to Star Trek II, and they say that was an idea that Harve Bennett and Leonard Nimoy cobbled together between the two of them, I think.
Yeah, well, I think it was Nimoy's idea that that McCoy be carrying the Katra, which is essentially Spock's mind and spirit. Because famously, when they were coming to the end of Star Trek II and they had screened it for audiences, people really liked it, except at the ending, because it was Spock died and that was it. And as Harv Bennett said, it was kind of an ultimate downer. And it was Michael Eisner, who was running Paramount at the time, who said to him, he said, the problem is you have Good Friday, but you don't have Easter Sunday. And Bennett said he knew they needed some kind of hope in there. He always claimed that they didn't have it worked out how they were going to bring Spock back. I find that a little hard to believe, basically, yeah, considering how easy it went. But supposedly what they did is they did the reshoot of, well, not the reshoot, the additional shooting of the casket on the planet. And they also did a reshoot or an insert, really, in the radiation sequence when Spock's going in to die. He does a mind meld with McCoy, and supposedly that's where he transfers his Katra to him. But what Nimoy said is all they did was a gesture. They didn't really know what it was going to mean. They just did something so that Harv Bennett would have a thread to pick up on. I can't believe they didn't work the whole thing out right there, but you know, I'll go with what those two guys said, but I don't believe it.
Yeah, it sounds a little far-fetched to me too. Yeah,
I think so, but it's almost a little too perfect. Although they didn't really include all of that in the original outline, so who knows what they were doing. But anyway, it was Nimoy and Bennett who put the script together. And it was also, I believe, Nimoy's idea to do the Ponfar sequence, where they don't quite spell it out, but essentially Spock has sex with Savik in order to not go crazy, which, you know, on paper sounded a little hokey, but I actually think it's one of the more sort of ethereal and effective scenes in the film. Mm-hmm. So I think Nimoy knew what he was doing with that, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it is one of the more effective scenes. You're right about that. Yeah, it's funny, Harv Bennett, you know, I just happened to think while we're sitting here chatting about him, I guess this was not something that he was doing for the first time, bringing back a character who had died, because I was thinking about the Bionic Woman television series.
Yep.
And it was a similar thing, because the Bionic Woman was supposed to be a one-off episode, and the viewers wrote in and really was angry at the fact that they were really so angry that she had been killed, and so they came back and gave her her own series, of course with the help of Kenneth Johnson, who later created the Incredible Hulk. But I think Bennett was the producer, and so I think the plot was she was frozen for some strange reason.
She didn't die. They put her in a coma or something.
That's what it was. Yeah.
I don't even know.
So yeah, he was drawing from a well that he had already gone down, is what I'm trying to get at.
It wasn't the biggest challenge for him, I don't think. So
he's like, I've been here, fellas. I've done this before. Right. Hold on, we'll work it out. But yeah. So I think, you know, it's interesting, because even if they had ended Star Trek II with Spock's death and not filmed that extra footage, they still could have concocted something to bring him back without that footage. I mean, it's obviously made audiences appreciate the film more. But even if they had not, I'm sure they would have gone this route anyway, is what I'm getting at.
Sure. I mean, you know, if you look at the history of all these kind of sequels, they always find some way to pull it out.
Yeah, that's right.
If they didn't do the planet sequence in Star Trek II, you would have just seen Spock's casket, you know, zoom into orbit, and I suppose think it burned up. But they would have just done what they did anyway. No, guess what? It didn't burn up. Here, we found it on the planet. So, and of course, the whole idea of Genesis Planet is that, you know, it creates life where there is no life. So, you know, you're pretty much gilding the lily if you don't bring him back, you're kind of missing a huge opportunity. But supposedly, and I it only comes from her, so I don't know. And Harv is gone, so you can't ask him. But the actual idea of the planet regenerating Spock as opposed to just reviving him, you know, like they could have done him just coming back to life as an adult. As they finally settled on it, you know, he starts basically as a bunch of spores and then grows into a little kid and then an older kid and so on. Supposedly that idea came from Susan Sackett, who was Gene Roddenberry's secretary at the time. She has always said that Bennett gave her credit for that. I haven't actually read the place where he did, but I have no reason not to believe that. So, you know, the ideas came from all over the place. Mm-hmm. But they, you know, I think you can make a, I mean, the script for Star Trek III, which was solely written by Harv Bennett, famously Star Trek II went through many, many writers. It started with a guy named Jack B. Sowards, who was a TV writer, and, it went through a couple of other writers. Harv Bennett himself did a lot of writing on it. All before Nick Meyer came on and really wrote the script that you saw. Well, Harv Bennett wrote the script himself with Leonard Nimoy's input, but Bennett did all of the major writing. And it is nowhere near as solid a script as Star Trek II. It doesn't have, you know, all of the sort of thematic layers and things. And the story construction itself is not terrific. There's a lot of loose ends and unexplained things in it, the most significant one being the crew hijacks the Enterprise to go back to Genesis to get Spock's body, but they don't really ever get confirmation that the body is there. They only find it out once they arrive. And the other piece of it is no one ever explains why they need the body to put his brain, like if all of his essence was supposed to sort of go to heaven. Not really sure why they needed the body to do that. You know, that's a big hole in the plot. But I find the thing I like about Star Trek III the most is that it's not so much that it has a great story, but it's a movie of a lot of great moments. And I think they succeeded very well with the moments, maybe a little less well with the plot, but we all knew where it was going and it got there. So
yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, I think Nick Meyer's writing sensibilities, I think, are certainly missed on this one. Because he has some of the Shakespearean overtones, I guess you would say, that you get from the, I don't know, maybe that's not the correct way to describe it, but...
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah, but that you get from Star Trek II is just not here. But yeah, you're right. There are some good moments in this film and some moments of high emotion, maybe not as much as the previous film. So yeah, I revisited it in preparation for our discussion and, I don't think I'd seen it in about since it originally came out. I really don't.
Oh, okay.
It had been a long time. And, and it was interesting how, they say that Harv Bennett he wasn't sure how to introduce the story for people who had maybe not seen The Wrath of Khan, the previous installment. And right. So he said his TV producer mentality won out, quote unquote. And he added the previously in Star Trek film device, which, So the film opens with the scene from the climatic scene from the end of Star Trek II, where Spock is sacrificing himself, of course. And that kind of brings you into the current proceedings as they were.
Yes, yeah, for sure. And famously, they did a lot of restructuring of the story in the post production process because the original script it begins as it does in the film with sort of the recap, and then. They go down to the planet and they see the casket or the torpedo tube doubling as a casket. And then they pull back out through the clouds to the science ship arriving. And so they do the whole sequence where they discover that there's some life form on the planet. And then they go to the Klingon sequence where the Klingons show up and say, we're going to go get it. And only then did they introduce the Enterprise. in the film as it was finally released, the Enterprise is literally the first scene after the credits. And they did that because I believe they felt in watching it that the Enterprise crew had kind of gotten lost a little bit in that structure. But it ended up creating a continuity gaffe that still rankles some fans to this day, because at the end of Star Trek II, if you recall Star Trek II, Kirk begins in this kind of depressed place because he's turning 50 and he feels like his life is behind him. Mm-hmm. And even though they lose Spock, they go through the whole adventure of Wrath of Khan, in the end of the movie, he has found his optimism again. And the last lines are, he says, "I feel young." And it ends on this upbeat note where Kirk has essentially got his mojo back. And the way that Star Trek III was written, the reason Kirk is in kind of a down mood when we first meet him on the Enterprise is because they've already located the casket and they sent word to the Enterprise that, guess what? We found Spock's casket. And Kirk is very perturbed by what that means. Like, does that mean he's still alive? Like, he's not really sure. And so he's not in a positive place when you first meet him in Star Trek III. And by turning the scenes around, they took away the reason he was in a down mood. So people who are big fans of the series get frustrated because, like, well, he was so happy at the end and now he's so miserable. What's going on? Right. And, well, what's going on is they did some bad editing. So, yeah.
Yeah. Good point. Good point. Yeah. It's, there were lots of changes. You were speaking of changes because I know the Romulans were originally the villains, and then Leonard Nimoy preferred the more, he called them theatrical Klingons.
Yes.
And that was another thing. He said that it was they were analogous to, their pursuit of Genesis was analogous to the Soviet race for nuclear weaponry. Yes. That was happening at that time in the 80s. So that was another thing. Yeah, but so
there was one very big change in the casting. Should we go to that?
Yeah, I was gonna say. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we can discuss that. I'll let you get into it.
Sure. Well, the one of the most popular characters in Star Trek II was Savick. In that script, a half Vulcan, half Romulan, although they all those references were dropped, but played by Kirstie Alley in her first screen performance. And that character was a huge favorite and fans really liked it. And they really liked Kirstie Alley as Savick. And Savick was included in Star Trek III in the script, but Kirstie Alley was replaced by an actress called Robin Curtis. And the story for years and years was that they offered it to Kirstie Alley, but depending on who you talk to, she said they offered her this insultingly low amount of money, considering how big her character had become. They said they offered her less than they had offered her to do the first one, so she turned it down. If you listen to the Paramount side of it, they offered her a lot, but she wanted much, much more. She wanted even more than DeForest Kelly, and she wanted a different billing and all this kind of thing. And so they couldn't come to terms. I've never really bought either of those stories because that just doesn't seem likely given how these things go.
Yeah.
What I have heard, and I've heard this, I don't have this confirmed, but it actually makes a lot more sense to me, is apparently neither Nimoy nor Shatner liked working with Kirstie Alley. At the very least, Nimoy didn't. And he apparently did not really want her to reprise the role. And if they did offer her an insultingly low amount of money, I suspect that was deliberate so she would turn it down, so that he could recast the part. That seems more plausible to me. Doesn't necessarily, like, I don't know what his thinking was there, but that seems more realistic than she asked for like five times the money or something like that. But supposedly that's really the reason she was replaced.
Yeah, that sounds, like you said, more plausible, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard things about her that she could be a little difficult, shall we say. So
apparently during the filming of Two, from what I've heard, she played around a lot. And I guess they just didn't feel she was professional. Now, in her defense, she was really young and it was her first movie. Yeah. But still, you're supposed – I mean, she was famously redubbed. Because with her own voice, but her apparently her performance, her vocal performance, was considered quite flat, and they had to kind of go back and post and redo it. So I think there was just some decision that between maybe her behavior and her performance, I think Nimoy felt maybe he could do better or something. I mean, I think they ultimately made a mistake, with no disrespect to Robin Curtis, who does as good a job as she can, but Allie made such an impression in that part that even if she was a handful, you know, I do think the movie misses something by not having her there. And also Nimoy had directed Robin Curtis to play the part very much like a Vulcan, whereas Kirstie Alley played it with a little more energy and emotion, because again, she was supposed to be half Romulan, mm-hmm. half Vulcan. Nimoy wanted the character played flat out. And my brothers and I have this discussion all the time. The problem is there are only two actors I've ever seen other than Kirstie Alley who ever played a Vulcan in a believable way. And that's Leonard Nimoy and Mark Leonard, who plays Nimoy's dad, Savick. Mm-hmm. Not Savick, Sarek. Everybody else plays Vulcans like they're robots with no emotions. And as Leonard Nimoy famously said, he goes, "I play Spock like a man with all the emotions in the world, but he's trying to keep them in check." And I think the difference, like, I don't like anyone else who's ever played a Vulcan. I think they just do it flat and boring. And with no disrespect to Robin Curtis, I kind of find that that's what she did too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 Kirstie Alley is certainly missed. There's no doubt about it. You feel it. And I remembered that she didn't return, but I don't think that it bothered me as much when I saw it 40 years ago, but it really did resonate with me this time around for sure. So I guess as an adult, you kind of, you feel differently about these types of things. When you're a kid, you're kind of maybe a little more forgiving. I'm not sure.
you probably don't know what's going on half the time. I don't know. It's different.
So, so anyway, we can talk about the, as far as the casting, like, I guess we can go ahead and finish out, and talk about a little bit more of the casting with the, I'm drawing a blank now. The actor that plays Kirk's son, it's on the tip of my tongue.
Merritt Buttrick.
Yes.
He had played him in the second film, and they brought him back for this one.
So they were able to get him back, and that was, although, you know, his spoiler alert for anybody who hasn't
seen, for a 40-year-old film.
That's right, for a 40-year-old film, he doesn't make it all the way to the end credits.
No, he doesn't.
Yeah, he is sacrificed, or sacrifices himself, I guess you would say, to a certain degree, on the Genesis planet. And so, when Krug's and his gang try to get control of the Genesis planet or whatever, he's killed in the melee, I guess. Maybe
that's if you're gonna get Kirk mad at you, kill his son. And that's kind of what they did.
Does it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So,
One of the more interesting casting pieces is the villain Krug, the Klingon chief. Mm-hmm. Leonard Nimoy's original choice for that role was Edward James Olmos, who had done he'd already done Blade Runner at that point.
Yeah.
And he made a big splash on stage in Zoot Suit and all that. And I guess he came in and he gave this really super dynamic reading, and Nimoy wanted him. And I guess Gary Nardino did not want him. And I'm not sure why Gary Nardino didn't want him, but I guess it went back and forth. They kept bringing him back for screen tests. And then I guess finally, like, he almost lost patience, and Nimoy lost patience. But basically it came down from Gary Nardino, you can't cast him. And Nimoy was quite upset about that because he thought he'd be a terrific Klingon, which I do think he would have been, knowing the intensity of performances. I'm not 100% sure how Christopher Lloyd came to be cast. I do know I actually asked Gary about it once, but it was a very funny sort of Hollywood exchange because I said, Gary, whose idea was it to cast Christopher Lloyd in Star Trek III? And he looked at me and goes, did you like him? And I said, yeah. He goes, my idea. And then he walked away. So I guess if I said I didn't like him, he would have blamed it on somebody else. but I thought that was a very funny response. So yeah,
that's the way it typically works in Hollywood.
Exactly. And there's another sitcom star in the film, which some people may not be aware of. John Larroquette plays one of the Klingons in the film.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that is correct. Sure does. And I did want to mention, this is just kind of trivia, getting into trivia territory with this, but when you have the young version of the rapidly aging Spock, you get to Frank Welker did some of the Spock
yes.
screaming voices. He's the we know him better as, of course, Fred on the Scooby-Doo series. But many of the alts also voiced one of the Gremlins, I think Gizmo, and many other voices that he's done over the years. He's a very prolific voice artist, and he did some of the dubbing there for Spock's screams as he
excellent
as he rapidly ages. So we can talk a little bit about the design of the ILM work, who were contracted to do the special effects.
Right,
Industrial Light and Magic.
They had done the effects work for 2, but famously 2 is sort of a half and half movie because they reused a number of shots from Star Trek the Motion Picture. So ILM mostly was involved in anything involving the Reliant, which was Khan's ship, and then the final space battle in that film, that was mostly ILM. So they had done work on it, but they not extensively. And that film had been, the effect sequences had all been storyboarded by its line producer, a guy named Robert Salen, and basically delivered to ILM, and it was kind of bid like a commercial job, like, here's our storyboards, you know, execute our storyboards. On Star Trek III, ILM was brought in at the very beginning. They did most of the storyboard work for the effect sequences, and they were much more involved in the collaboration on that. The project was headed by Ken Ralston, who had also been one of the head effects guys on Star Trek II. And all of the effects in Star Trek III are new. They didn't reuse any. So it was kind of a fresh slate. That's part of the reason the budget was a little bit higher, because they were doing, you know, everything in it was new. They did the design work on the Bird of Prey. They famously did not do the design work on the Enterprise model, which had been built for the first film. Then that was reused. They designed they had done the Genesis effect in Star Trek II, which was reused here. And basically the big special effect sequence in this film was the destruction of the Enterprise, which they did in several sizes. They did a couple of miniature full ships. They had a half section of the hull. So they did a couple of different cuts there. But that's one of the more spectacular sequences in the film. Also emotional, because it's very hard to see the Enterprise get destroyed. But the way it goes into the atmosphere and then essentially turns into a comet, I think it's one of ILM's more beautiful sequences from that time.
Yeah, it is. It's very effective. Yeah, I certainly concur on that.
And they also designed Krug's dog, which was a hand puppet covered in slime, which cracks me up. I'm not sure he doesn't look like anything but a hand puppet, but I think he's awesome.
Well, you know, I would much rather have something that's actually physically there with the actors.
Absolutely.
And you can tell it makes the difference, when you're interacting with something that they can actually physically touch.
ILM also designed the space dock, which as many people has pointed out, is kind of an illogical concept. Like, probably you weren't really going to have a big barn full of spaceships in space. You probably just would have moored them in space. But it's a cool looking design.
Yeah.
And it gives them something to break out of. And that's very cool, too. And ILM designed the Excelsior, which is supposed to be the next generation starship. That was not an intentional pun. That was unintentional. I apologize for the pun. It was supposed to be, you know, the next evolution of the starships above the Enterprise, of course, leading to the joke where Scotty disables it, and it's not such a great ship after all. So it's a fun, exciting thing and a good joke in the movie too.
Yeah. Yeah. You were, you were mentioning the Krug's dog or whatever.
Yeah.
Yes. They called, I think there was, they actually called him on set Fifi Rebozo. That's what the effects team named it, which is a reference, and you'll have to be a little older to get this one. That's a reference to a Bebe Rebozo, who was an American Florida-based banker and businessman who was a friend and confidant of Richard Nixon.
That's right.
For those of us who grew up in the 70s like myself, we get that joke. So.
Yes, if you grew up steeped in Watergate, you'll know exactly who we're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Yep,
yep. I wasn't aware of that. That's very funny.
Yeah,
that's,
I thought it was too. I had to mention that, so... Just a little trivia that I did in my research, figured out, found out the things you find.
The film was shot all on sound stages at Paramount. There was some talk originally of going and shooting the Genesis Planet stuff in Hawaii, on Kauai, but the budget just wouldn't allow for it. So the Genesis Planet was actually, there's two stages at Paramount. I believe it's 14 and 15, where there are two stages next door to each other, but you can pull open. There's the wall that separates them, so you end up getting this big, gigantic area. And apparently, so the whole thing was built there, and built a bit on risers because they had earthquakes happening, so you have to kind of build the set so it can be separated. The only outdoor footage they shot for it was at the very end when they arrive on Vulcan and they bring Spock's body down off the ship, and they're going to carry it up to the sacrificial to the holy place. That was Occidental College, the fountain in Los Angeles, that I think they shot there one night. And that was the only non-soundstage work done on the film. So Nimoy was confined to the stages as he directed.
Sure, that made him happy on his first sojourn behind the camera. Yeah,
yes.
A lot of course, they were penny pinching, as you mentioned earlier. And some of the sets, and particularly those interiors, they were redresses of his existing sets, too, according to what I've read.
So, yeah, most of them were. Yeah. Or just sort of cobbled together sets, like the merchantman ship in the beginning is literally just a console and some crates behind netting. Like, there is no other part of the set. So the one angle you see it from is all that was built. I would say that's one of the places you see the budget in the film, unfortunately, because I think most of the sets are not, you know, they look like they were made for a price. They don't have a lot of texture and detail. They got away with a lot in Star Trek II, and Star Trek I, of course, had a very elaborate production design. I think most of the money on this film was spent on the Genesis Planet, and the rest of it, I think, they did as economically as they could.
Yeah, I guess you got to pinch pennies somewhere, and I guess that's where they decided to save the money. Yeah, some of the chairs were reupholstered, I think, and the central navigation console was rotated to modify the floor plan.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, I the Enterprise set was, I was lucky enough to get on it a couple of times years ago. It doesn't exist anymore, unfortunately, but they could pull that thing out, and it was done in like pie wedges. And they could rearrange it. I believe the Excelsior Bridge is a new construct. I don't think that's the Enterprise Bridge, but it literally is only one wall and the control console. And you're right. They pulled the seats out and recovered them from the Enterprise. So they recycled a lot of Enterprise stuff there. And I believe the science vessel was the Enterprise Bridge, but again, reconfigured in a couple ways. But that's actually smart. Producing, if you can get away with it, it looks great. I just think they, some of the other sets, like the Merchantman bridge, I don't think looked particularly good. And I think the bar scene where McCoy tries to hire a starship, that's the sick bay of the Enterprise redressed. And my problem is, to me, it looks like it. It doesn't look like a real place, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Well, they were no stranger to doing that sort of thing, because in Wrath of Khan, obviously, they had some of those props being reused from the motion picture. So it was not the first time they had tried that trick.
Right, right. And if you look carefully, like the prison that they break McCoy out of is actually the hallways of the regular one space station from Star Trek II. They just sort of painted over them. And those flats were out in the parking lot where I used to park my car when I worked at Paramount. Like, so I was always parking by the sick bay all the time. So it was kind of funny.
It's pretty good. Yeah, they say for the makeup that Tom Berman, the legendary makeup artist, he was only given his contract 3 weeks before they started photography. So they were he had to really get going really quickly.
Yeah. And that, they had a lot of makeup effects. They in sure that. Did, probably yeah. More than they had in other ones, because they had to not only take Spock through several different ages, but then they did one of those change-o heads where his face is sort of contorting on camera. And that kind of thing, that takes a lot of preparation to do. So I actually hadn't known that it was only 3 weeks ahead of time, but that must have been some pressure. That couldn't have been fun.
Yep. He did some great work on many films, including I think he did the transformation in The Beast Within. We talked about that on our Psycho 2 episode that was written by Tom Holland. That's a pretty, regardless of your feelings about that film, that transformation sequence is pretty spectacular. Yeah, he did that.
And they did some of the ET heads in Close Encounters as well.
Yeah, that's right. An Invasion of the Body Snatchers, starring, ironically enough, Leonard Nimoy.
That is a great movie.
Sure is. Sure is. Yeah, I turned my son onto it at a very young age, and he just recently beat me to the punch by getting the Arrow 4K, which is a UK only.
Okay.
So he got that. I said, well, I guess I raised you well.
I have a brother who has never forgiven me for taking him to see that movie because of the dog head with the dog with the human head that looks to this day he gets mad at me.
That's great. Oh my goodness. Well, the actual principal photography commenced on August 15th, 1983, and of course we talked about the sound stages. All but two days of production were filmed on those sound stages, and they say it's one of the first major feature films to use the Eastman 5294. That's a color high speed negative film stock that allowed a certain latitude in choosing a broad range of exposure indexes. I know I'm getting technical here, but it was shot with anamorphic lenses, of course, as all of the Star Trek films were. And, I think there were some release prints in 70 millimeter, too. So,
I believe that's right. Yeah, because they, in those days, I didn't realize this at the time, but the whole purpose of 70 millimeter was really to introduce the six channel stereo rather than just the larger picture. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I do think in the big city downtown houses, they did do it in 70 millimeter. Charlie Carell shot it. And he had done, most of the people who worked on Star Trek II and III were, mostly people who had done a lot of work in television. There wasn't a lot of big feature people involved, so these were folks getting their shot. It's an interesting looking film because famously the original series was done in these very striking, sort of bold primary colors, because NBC was trying to promote color television at the time. And that the series was mostly filmed by Jerry Finnerman. And in Star Trek, the motion picture, they shot it in a very monochromatic look, which was actually on purpose. That was a decision that Robert Weiss and Richard Klein made. They had more color in Star Trek II, like the sets were a little more colorful. But what Charles Carell wanted to do in III is he wanted to use like colored lighting in a lot of places to sort of not necessarily replicate the look of the television show, but to pay homage to it. I think the problem is some of the colors that were chosen were not quite primary, so sometimes it looks a little off. But there are several sequences, like I think the big fight at the end on Genesis, and a lot of the stuff in like when they're stealing the Enterprise and things. Like I think that's where his work is really effective, like where his use of sort of overuse of color works really well. It's a little less good, I think, in some of the earlier scenes, but you know, he was experimenting. So
yeah. And by all reports, I think Charlie Carell was also unhappy that every scene except one was filmed on a soundstage. He wasn't too happy about that either, I don't think.
He really wanted to go to Hawaii, and I think they had a bigger budget, that would have been a good idea.
Oh, yeah.
But they also had to do the planet falling apart. And one of the things is now with CG, you might be able to meld those things, but there was no way you were ever going to be able to shoot that stuff anywhere except a stage. And I do think there was concern that like a live action Hawaii footage would not intercut with the stage stuff so well, which was one of the problems they had on the 70s King Kong. They had actual footage of Kauai and then stage bound sets. And I think each looked fine. They didn't necessarily intercut very believably. And I think that was a concern as well.
Yep. Yep. I think you're right on the money on that. Yeah. So, with that Eastman stock that he was using, he had to, because of the 70 millimeter prints, he also had to keep that image very crisp, because that when you're a 70 millimeter print will allow you to see things that a normal 30
yes
it's a lot of anomalies
less forgiving, as we say.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
I mean, this is getting way into the nerd weeds here, but the most feature films before the introduction of that new stock was 5247, and for my money that was my favorite film stock, because it just reproduced colors really wonderfully.
Mm-hmm.
The later ones I didn't like as much, because I thought like the skin tones and things got a little muddier, but that was because that was the trade-off for it having more light latitude. But again, being such a nerd, I can always tell when they made the shift, because I was like, oh, all that wonderful color is not quite there anymore. but oh well, you know.
Agreed. Yeah. Well, we've talked a lot about the technical stuff here, so we can get into the post-production stuff. And one of those notable things about post-production is James Horner returning for the search for Spock after doing such a great job on The Wrath of Khan.
Yeah, no, he made a huge impact, and he had always told the story that Harv Bennett said, if we give you the job on two, you got to come back on three. And he agreed. And I love his score for Star Trek III, because his score for two is great. It's exciting, and it's sort of, very traditional in its use of themes and his action music. What I love about three is that he takes a lot of the themes that he created for Star Trek II, and he makes them much more sort of, I don't know what the best word would be, but much more ethereal,
mm-hmm.
much more mysterious, much more poetic. So it's sort of a nice, he takes what he did in two and takes it in a whole other direction in three. It's one of my favorite of his scores. I think it's just beautiful.
Yeah. And there's a cue that he wrote specifically for the film. It was a new one, a theme for the Klingons, which is featured pretty prominently in that film.
And in Aliens.
Yeah, that's yeah, that's true.
That was James's thing. He would kind of reuse stuff all over. I met him once and I mentioned something about his Star Trek scores, and he was very funny because he would just sort of he was a little bit cranky about it. He goes, "Oh, you heard my score over the engines of the Enterprise? Great." So I guess he didn't love the mix. I think he thought the engines got more prominence than his music. So.
I thought it was funny how the music author Jeff Bond described it. He said that cue was a compromise between music from Wolfen, which he had done in 1981, right? And Khan's motif from The Wrath of Khan.
Well, you know, James.
Yeah, that's right.
Getting it all together.
So, yep.
No, it's a lovely piece. And I think it goes well because one of the things I love about ILM's effects is they also have, especially in the end, after the destruction of the Enterprise, there's sort of a painterly quality to it as they watch the ship crash to the planet. And I love all the stuff in the end when they go to Vulcan with sort of the orange sunset all over. Like it shows its age a little bit. Some of the compositing is maybe not as smooth as we would expect these days, but I think the shots are beautifully designed and just wonderfully lit. And that's obviously a collaboration between Charles Carell and the ILM folks. But I think it and Horner's music, I really love the final sequence in the movie where they take Spock to Vulcan and restore him. It just has a weird poetic quality to it, you know, that I really think works in every way.
Yeah. It does. It's very well done and very effective the way it's staged. I always thought that the death of of Kirk's son, though, in the film, I wasn't quite as emotional for me as I maybe wanted or hoped.
Yeah. Well, I think that there's a combination of things there. The first thing is that like we didn't really know that character. Like he came in the previous film. There's an old sort of axiom in television writing that says nobody cares about the guest star. It means like don't give all the emotional scenes to the guest cast. You want to give it to the primary cast. So I also think that it throws the movie off because Kirk blows up his ship in order to save Spock. So you get the emotional destruction of the Enterprise and the payoff is, but we get Spock back. And the problem is David kind of gets lost in the shuffle. And I figure like in real life, Captain Kirk, I think would be way more upset about the death of his son than the death of the ship. And then the weird part is once they kind of get off the planet, nobody talks about David again. Like Kirk doesn't seem to reference him.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And my understanding, again, I don't have this firsthand, but is Shatner, apparently he and Buttrick didn't get along very well. And if you notice, like they have no scenes together in the movie. They have one exchange over radio. So I think the death would have had more impact if you'd actually seen them interacting in the movie. But they never meet in the film. And also it does smack a little bit of what it was, which was Bennett was looking for a sacrificial lamb. They had to have some impact on the story. But I also think they had decided there wasn't much else they could do with David. So it was kind of like, how do we get rid of this character? And I think it kind of plays a little bit like that, like a convenience a little bit more than a natural outgrowth of the drama. So I think for all those reasons, it's not quite as impactful as it could be.
Yeah, that's a good summation of that situation, I would say. So, yeah, that... I always hoped that it, or I guess wanted a little more from that. But yeah, that explains it with Shatner and the two of them not getting along, I meant to say. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you might notice a theme of Shatner not getting along with people.
Yeah. But, it's a theme but that apparently seems that to persist. So.
Yeah. But I don't know. But I also think, like, you know, if you're evaluating the film critically, like, I think Nimoy did a terrific directing job on Star Trek IV. Like, it really flows well, and it has a good big screen look. I think his work on Star Trek III early on in the film is a bit perfunctory. Like, it does seem a little like a TV show. Everything is shot well, but it's not, there's not much style to it. I think it gets better as it goes along, but I think David's death, maybe a more experienced director would have milked it a little differently or something.
Yeah.
I do think Nimoy comes into his own in the Vulcan sequence. Like, I think he does a really good job with that sequence. But I think that was probably done near the end of the schedule. He'd gotten his feet under him a little bit, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That would explain it. Yeah. So, we talked about already, leading into this episode, about how much it made. I'll repeat that, though. It was $76.5 million in North America for a total of $87 million worldwide, and opened in almost 2,000 theaters, not quite, 1,996 across North America. And this was at a time it was competing in the summer of 84 with Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, Gremlins, Ghostbusters, and Top Secret.
What a lousy summer that was, huh?
Yeah, I know, really. Bad summer. Unfortunately.
Nothing to see.
Yeah, yeah, boy. An embarrassment of riches. Top Secret, of course, didn't do a whole lot that summer, but has in the years since then become one of the a go-to film for fans of the Zucker brothers, myself included. Yes. Yeah, and it was interesting, the marketing. There was not heavily marketed, but there were some tie-ins. There was a promotional merchandise. There were branded calendars, glasses sold at Taco Bell. Novelization, which reached second place on the New York Times paperback bestsellers list.
And, I bought it. I still have it here on the shelf somewhere.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Interestingly enough, President Ronald Reagan, who was leaned toward the Rambo films and that sort of thing, he screened the films for friends during a weekend away from the White House in 1984, and he wrote of the film, I think it was in his diary, "It wasn't too good," quote unquote.
Well, if Ronald Reagan didn't like it. Yeah. It also had a bit of a... I don't know if it was a marketing controversy, but I know it ticked off Harv Bennett, because obviously the big surprise of the movie is that they blow up the Enterprise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he said, you know, they wanted to make that the big shock for the audience. He goes, and then Paramount walks in like a couple weeks before it was released and says, "Here's the commercials we've cut for it." And literally the first commercial was the Enterprise blowing up and the voiceover saying, "Join us for the last voyage of the Starship Enterprise." He goes, "Oh, well, so much for trying to keep something secret."
I'm not sure that sort of thing is done way too much now. Back then, that wasn't quite as common of an occurrence.
Right.
We've come to expect it all. I try to avoid as many trailers as possible for those reasons.
Exactly. I try to watch nothing anymore because it'll spoil everything at this point.
Exactly.
So.
Yeah.
I'll tell you why I actually really like this film a lot. And if you the famous lore of Star Trek is that the even numbered movies are good, 2, 4, and 6, and the odd numbered ones are not good. That's the sort of, you know, shorthand people use. But I actually really like this film, and I like it for a couple of reasons. It is nowhere near as good as Star Trek II. I totally admit that it doesn't have the solidness of that film. But it's funny, I have an interesting relationship with Star Trek. When I was a kid when it was first being syndicated, and I watched the whole series and I liked it, but I was never like a super Trekkie or anything. I liked the show very much. I thought it was decent. I found it very entertaining and very smart, which I think it remains to this day. But I never got caught up like in all of that intense fandom that grew up in the 70s. And I actually found it a little bit annoying sometimes because they would always write about the characters in a way that I never saw them in the show. Like they were always talking about how, you know, Scotty's in love with his ship and, you know, Sulu has like a romantic heart and Kirk, you know, is this dedicated guy. And when you watch the show, most of that wasn't there. When I saw this film, like Nimoy really brought out the best in the cast, and everybody suddenly, I thought, had much more vibrant personalities than they had had in the other films. I mean, Star Trek II is a great film, so I'm not putting it down, but Nimoy gave every cast member in this movie their own moment. And so, you know, I think his interplay with McCoy is great. I love that line, you know, that green-blooded son of a bitch. It's his revenge for all the arguments he lost. You know, yeah. It's like very funny. Sulu gets that great moment. Don't call me Tiny. So everybody got a chance to shine. And so for the first time, I found the supporting characters as vibrant as the fans always said they were. So I really like that element of it. And as I've said already a couple times, I think the ending is really good. I think it's really well written. It's got a lot of emotion as Spock gets his memory back. It's got kind of a weird spiritual quality. And there's a great moment. You have to look carefully. But clearly Nimoy did an improvisation that Shatner wasn't expecting. He like does that thing where Spock raises his eyebrow and you can see Shatner crack up from behind because clearly he wasn't expecting it. So it had a lot of feel for the characters that I had not gotten from some of the earlier productions. Like I really thought all of the characters came across great in this film. So I've always had a soft spot in my heart for it. Plus, I thought it was the gutsy as hell to blow up the Enterprise. I thought it was great.
Yeah, that was quite a surprise, and even rewatching it still kind of surprises you. I mean, you remember it, but the way it's done very effectively. So yeah, so it could have gone much worse for a first time director. Let's put it that
sure,
way.
As
William Shatner would find out a couple of entries down the road.
We have a conversation in a couple of years. We're gonna have to have about that one.
I think so. Yeah. But so this has been really great revisiting the behind the scenes goings on the production of Star Trek III: The Search for Spock. Appreciate you coming on to banter it up about this film because I think it deserves to be remembered on its 40th anniversary.
Yeah, I'm glad we were able to do it. We're keeping our record good on our Star Trek films, so we got to keep going, and our Bond films. So we'll keep going.